Hello and welcome to the Marketing Meetup podcast. Thank you very, 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 very much for listening in today. Today we have the incredible April Dunford. I say incredible because she is one of the leaders in the world at positioning, but she is also someone who is just great company to be around. She's funny and she's smart and she's experienced. I think you're going to really like her. In this session, we focused on how to get the most out of the first call or the first pitch that you have with someone. Now, this feels like something that feels oddly specific, but the reason for focusing on this session today was that so often we focus on acquisition of new customers, but rarely do we think about making the most of the pipeline that we already have. And in an economic environment which is increasingly challenging or just challenging full stop, then making the most of the leads that you already have in the business is just as important as generating new ones, if not more important. Both Bryony Thomas and Asia Arangi, in the past have shared how optimizing as close to the purchase stage as possible will be the most effective actions that you can do as a marketer. So this was a brilliant session. It was also co-hosted with a friend of TMM and one of our organizers, Diane Weirdo, who is a messaging expert. So you'll hear Diane throughout the course of this session. Before we get going, I want to say a big thank you to Exclaimer. They're the featured sponsor for this episode. And the reason I love Exclaimer's product is that it speaks to caring about the small things. Exclaimer allows you to manage email signatures across your business, enabling you to make sure you get consistency across them, but then also start to use your email signatures as a marketing channel. Now, this may sound like a little thing, but if you think about the amount of emails that your team, your company will send every day, then there are these small little opportunities to let your colleagues, your folks that you're interacting with, about the things going on in your world. Exclaimer enables not only consistency, but also for you to use a subtle but powerful marketing channel. Well worth checking out. And with all that said, my introduction is now done. So I'm going to hand over to Diane for the first question to the very brilliant April Dunford. Enjoy.
So I thought we'd start off with some kind of positioning basics to kind of make sure that everyone is all on the same page. So you define positioning as how your product is a leader at delivering something that a well-defined set of customers cares about. So I love that definition.
That's
so
good. You can do this.
Yeah. I'm good with messaging. I'll leave the positioning to you.
Good. You got it.
So why is it important that we have this clearly defined positioning if we want to get the most out of our pipeline?
Yeah. So positioning is often misunderstood. So people will often confuse messaging and positioning, or positioning and branding, or positioning and the things that come from positioning after we've got it nailed. Like, the thing about positioning is it's all about getting really tight and having a really succinct definition of who do we compete with? How are we different? What is the value we can deliver to customers that no one else can? Who exactly is a best fit customer for our stuff? And what is the market that we intend to win? We can't do anything good in marketing and sales until we have that really tightly tied down. So if we're looking at messaging or branding, like, the first question I'm going to ask is, well, who's the message for? And you know, why pick us over the other guys? But what I see a lot in sales pitches, and part of the reason why I'm interested in this and wrote a book on this, is a lot of the companies that I work with, they spend all this time on messaging and positioning over on the marketing side. And then you walk over to sales and you see what's happening in sales, and sales is doing none of that. Like, sales is basically doing what I would call a product feature walkthrough. So, you know, they're like, okay, we're in the product now, we're logging in, there's 7 drop-down menus, and I'm going to click on every single one and talk about every single feature underneath there. The problem with that is it doesn't reflect our positioning. Like, our positioning is all about what's the value we can deliver no one else can. And so when the prospect gets to sales and sales is just talking about features, it's not really answering the question, like, why pick us over the other folks you might be looking at? So that's why I think positioning is really important. We got to nail it for messaging and the things we're doing on the marketing side, but we also got to nail it so that we can do a better job of talking to customers once they reach sales.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And I see this kind of in the work that I do too. So how do we start to translate that positioning into a sales story that we can actually present to prospects then? Let's say that we've got those key components that you talk through and the unique attributes. What are the next steps?
Yeah. So the first thing we have to understand is, like, we really need to look at this from a customer's point of view. So let's say I'm a prospect. I come in, like, what do I actually want in a sales pitch? And I think this is a good question to think about. So if you look at the research on this, there's two things that I think are really important to understand. The first one is that the data tells us that in B2B, 40 to 60% of B2B sales purchase processes end in no decision. So what that means is the customer decided, hey, we need to go buy something, you know, like a new accounting software or something. And they went out and they looked at all the options and they're like, no, we're not going to buy anything. Now, when you scratch at that data, you would think that that means that they looked at all the options and they decided that the thing they're doing now is better. But it turns out that's not true. In the majority of cases, they cannot figure out how to confidently make a decision, and therefore they make none. So that's the first thing. Customers are overwhelmed. Too many features, too many options, too many other alternatives. And the person in charge of making a choice, there's stakes involved. Like, if they make a bad choice, bad things happen. Like, they might look dumb in front of their boss. Everybody in the department, you know, if they don't like this new tool, they're going to hate them. If the tool doesn't work, there's a potential they might get fired. So it's much easier for that person to go in, look at all the options, and then say, you know what? Let's just not make a decision now at all. The thing we got now, it works good enough. We'll just stay there. So that's the first thing to understand. The second thing to understand is that if we look at the data on what does a B2B buyer actually want in a sales presentation, the data tells us there's two big things that they're looking for. One is perspectives on the market. Now, that makes sense because they're coming to you with all these different choices and they're looking at all these products. They all look the same. And they're like, tell me about how all these things fit. Like, how are you different than these other things? How does this all fit together? And then the second thing they want is they want help making choices, meaning they want to understand what are the trade-offs with different approaches. And we're not giving them any of that in a product walkthrough where we're just showing the features. So if we think about it that way, a great sales pitch needs to do a bunch of extra things. Like, yes, obviously we want to show them the product, but before we get to showing the product, we actually want to paint a picture of the whole market and say, look, there's different approaches to this problem. And some companies take this approach, and here's the pluses and minuses of that. Other companies take this approach, and here's the pluses and minuses of that. And we've chosen to take this approach, and here's how it's different, and here's the value for you. And then if we want to show the product, what we should be doing is showing the features within the context of the value the features deliver. So once I've set it up that way, I can say, well, here's the value I can deliver. No one else can. Let me show you how we do that. So that's a very different way of thinking about a sales pitch than just saying, I got 29 features and I'm going to walk you through all 29. And buddy, it's your job to figure out which ones are different and which ones aren't and why any of these features might make sense to you or not. Don't talk to me. I'm just a demo jockey. You do the work, customer.
That's amazing. Honestly, like, I think Amy is bang on in the chat here, who says everyone frantically reaching for their notepads here because that was unreal as an answer, April. Thank you. And I wanted to, it's difficult. I'm not trying to do a spelling test here, but I'd love to know if you've got any examples of like opening sentences or anything like that, you know, where you can kind of go like, you know, the first couple of sentences. Because I went to an expo the other day. And I had a series of people who did exactly what you've said. You know, they said, this is the feature, this is the feature, this is the feature. The one pitch that stood out to me on that day was when someone stopped and said, you know that feeling when, and then they told a bit of a story, and that sort of grabbed me in and stuff like that. So when you're thinking about those first few sentences, do you have any examples of how you would launch into that?
Oh yeah. So I'm going to give you the full example, and I'm going to show you what the feature version looks like and what the not feature version looks like. So, so I got a couple of examples that are good ones because they're simple and people understand them. So, I did some work with a company called Help Scout. So Help Scout is in the customer service space. So think Zendesk, like they're in that space. Now, Help Scout was specifically designed for online businesses. So businesses where they don't have a storefront and they don't have salespeople to sell stuff. So they have a particular point of view on the market. And when they built the product, it was built with this insight in mind. And the insight is this. In a digital products business, customer service is very different. And so in a regular business, you might think of customer service as a cost center where you're just trying to get the people off the phone as fast as possible, get them to the FAQ, make sure that your service people talk to them for as little as possible. In a digital business, that's all upside down. In a digital business, this is your only chance where you get to interact with a customer. And so you want to love the heck out of them. And the research shows that if you give them a really great customer experience, loyalty goes up, repeat purchases go up, revenue goes up. So very different. So that's their insight. Now, if you look at who they compete with, most digital businesses start by using a shared inbox. So they just have everybody, they have a support email address. People are all in the shared inbox. That works great when you're really small. But when things start to grow, you start wanting to do things like assignments and prioritization and things that you would get in professional customer service software. So then they end up having to upgrade and they're looking at help desk software, we're like Zendesk, which has all the service bells and whistles, but it has two big problems. One, really hard to use. So not like using the shared inbox anymore. Two, it was designed with this idea that this is a cost center. So, you know, it doesn't call you by your name, you're assigned a ticket number. And you know, it's trying to push you off to the FAQ or low cost channels. All right, so that's the setup. Now, if Help Scout did the features pitch, here's how it would look. They'd be like, hey, prospect, here's how you log in. Oh, look, we have all these things. Look, I got a shared inbox. That's really nice to use. But look, I also have prioritizations and assignments and feature. And I keep going until I ran out of features. Now, the problem with that is some of that sounds like what you have right now. Sounds like a shared inbox. We have that. Some of it sounds like Zendesk, like they got all those features. In fact, maybe they got a couple more. So why pick you over the other guys? I don't know. I got to figure it out. Instead, they pitch it like this. So they start with three steps. The first step is their insight into the market, how they look at the market differently. The second step is other alternatives, pluses and minuses. Third step is, can we get agreement on what really good looks like? So it goes like this. Hey, e-commerce business. Great to see you. We work with e-commerce businesses. And you know what? We've seen that e-commerce businesses look at service in a different way. In fact, they look at it as a growth driver rather than a cost center, because we know if we could deliver a great customer experience, loyalty goes up, revenue goes up. In fact, I got some data on that. Here it is, right? That's my opening shot. Customer says, yeah, yeah. And you say, okay, well, look, you got choices. There's different ways you can solve this problem. Most folks start with a shared inbox. Did you do that? Yeah, yeah, we did. Oh, yeah, shared. You know what's great about a shared inbox? Really easy to use. Your reps love it. Everybody loves it. Problem is, you start growing, you're going to want things like assignments, prioritization, things like that. So now what are you looking at? You're looking at help desk software. Now, help desk software is great. It's got all the bells and whistles, all the stuff you need. But here's the downside. Your reps are going to have to learn how to use it. That ain't easy. And the second thing is, it was designed for a different kind of business. It was designed for a business where customer service is a cost center. So it's going to assign your people a ticket number. It's going to shove them to low-cost channels. That's my second one, right? Second step. Third step is perfect world, where I go, look, like if we really wanted to do customer service well, and we really believe that customer service is a growth driver, we kind of want a solution that does three things. We want it to be as easy to use as a shared inbox, because that's what your folks are used to using right now. But I'd want it to have all the bells and whistles so you don't have to outgrow it and switch platforms. But and then lastly, I'd want the thing to deliver an amazing customer experience, because that's what this game is all about. We want that, right? Now there's this little moment where I go, I do that right thing, and you're either with me or you're not. So if you're like, no, man, it's a cost center, then I disqualify you at that point. I got nothing for you. But if I'm a digital business, I go, yeah, I want that. And then you go, great. Okay, now I'm going to give you the demo. We got three things. Number one, shared inbox, nice, easy to use. Hey, look, our whole interface looks like that. Here's how it looks. We'll give you the demo. Number two, all the bells and whistles, never have to outgrow it. Here's how we do prioritizations. Here's how we do assignments. Here's how we do whatever. Last one, delivers an amazing customer experience. Look, we get to call you Dave instead of ticket number 10296. And look, you get the customer gets to choose which channel they communicate with under, and not just getting assigned to whatever the low cost channel is. So that's the difference in the pitch. Like, one is like blah, blah, blah features, and the work is all on the customer to figure out, why are we different? What's the value? What are we trying to do here? The other style of pitch is like, I'm going to set the context up front. I'm going to position everybody else and give you a mental map of the whole market. I'm going to convince you what a good thing looks like, because that's our point of view. And then I'm going to show you how we did that, which is really different.
I love that, April. I love about the insight that it allows you to kind of create that connection, but in a way that only you can, right? So sort of with that uniqueness that you bring. And I think it touches on what Joe mentioned before about that kind of relatability in the opener. I wonder what your thoughts are on tailoring those first call pitches to the buyer problem, because I know that I've seen and I've heard many companies who kind of start with some buyer discovery. They try to tweak that pitch based on you. And also, if I can kind of add a follow-up question, is it different for service-based businesses compared to product-based businesses regarding that tweak?
Yeah. These are two big questions. Great questions, though. So the first one, it's super interesting. Like, when I talk to very small businesses, they will often tell me, we have to do a custom pitch for everybody. Like, we just have to, because everybody's different and their problems are different and their situation's different and whatever. And yet, when I worked at IBM and was responsible for a product that did almost $1 billion in revenue, we had one pitch. For all 9,000 sales reps, one pitch. And the only thing we changed in that pitch was, when we did the customer example, we would pull in a customer example that looked like the customer we were sitting across from. And so I think what a lot of companies do is it's not actually discovery. It's more like what I would call sales therapy. Like, the customer comes in, and the sales rep shows up and says, tell me your problems. and the customer says, oh, problems, man. I got a lot of problems. Let me tell you about them. And there you are. You run a little startup. Like, you don't solve 90% of those problems. There is like one or two problems that you solve, which, by the way, we already know that the prospect has, because they never would have made it through our qualification process if we didn't solve that problem. So I'm not sure why we think we have to pretend that we solve all the problems. We don't. We solve a very narrow set of things. So that's the first thing. And you know, why not just get right to the meat of that instead of making the customer do all this extra work? Second thing is that, you know, again, coming back to this insight that customers often don't know what they don't know. Often the person you're selling to has never purchased software like yours before. So it's not like they know perfectly what their requirements are. It's not like they understand the whole market perfectly. So if we go in with this idea that you're going to tell me some stuff and I'm going to tailor the whole pitch to you, it's like pretending we don't know anything about the market, which is kind of bonkers. Like, we know way more about the market than customers do. Customers are experts in pain. We are experts in solutions. Why we don't want to share that expertise is kind of beyond me. So good discovery is not about walking in and saying, tell me your quest, tell me your problems, and list me your requirements for a solution, and then I'll try to pretend we meet all those requirements. Good discovery is actually a two-way conversation where you're getting more information about the customer's specific situation. So when I'm in that section of the pitch where I'm saying, like, let's take the Help Scout example. So I say, the first thing I'm saying is, look, we look at it like this. It's a growth driver, not a cost center. Do you agree? Like, that's discovery. Like, do you even see that or do you not see that? And if you don't see that, can I convince you? Because if I can't, I actually have nothing to sell you. The next thing is, when I'm walking through the alternative solutions, that's discovery too, right? So I'm saying, a lot of folks start with a shared inbox. Do you have a shared inbox? Is that what you're using today? Are you using something else? Well, that's interesting. Why did you decide to use that and not the shared inbox? Is there a requirement there that maybe is important that we need to think about? Have you looked at other things? Maybe you're looking at help desk software. What do you think about it so far? How do you feel like that's going to work for your team? Do you think that's going to be hard for your team to adopt? So do you see what I'm doing there? Part of what I'm doing is I'm educating you on the options and how they bucket. So they might say, oh, well, we're looking at this other company. They're called so-and-so. You're like, yeah, that's help desk software. It's just like all the other help desk software. It's going to assign you a ticket. It's going to do this thing. And so I'm doing discovery to figure out your exact situation, but I'm also teaching you a little bit about how all these solutions sort of fit into buckets. This is how we get over the no decision trap here, is helping the customer understand that they really understand all their choices in a way that they could go back and explain it to their boss and say, I picked this one for this reason, therefore I'm not going to get fired. So anyways, I think that's the first one. This discovery is done badly. And I think, unless I'm selling services software, I'm going to get to that one next, that doing a custom pitch for everybody, like, we don't do all the things. We just do one little thing. We should stop trying to pretend we do all the things. Now, let's say you're a services business. So let's say I'm a custom development shop. Now I can potentially do all the things. So maybe I do want to have this conversation at the beginning and say, oh, what do you want? Oh, I want a mobile app. Oh, well, okay, that's good. What kind of mobile app are you looking for? Well, I want a mobile app that does all these things. Oh, okay. And then I give you the pitch on how I think we're going to do that. Even then, if you look at successful folks that do custom development, they don't do custom development for everything. The ones that are really successful are highly specialized in something. So let's say I'm a highly specialized, well, I worked with a company that was highly specialized in doing bespoke retail headless commerce applications. So if the customer didn't want that, they wouldn't even come to them in the first place. So the customer's coming in and they're saying, look, their insight is they'll say, look, if you're doing bespoke custom headless commerce applications, like, there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong. And so what we think is that there are pieces of that that can be prepackaged almost like software. And we could start with these building blocks and then build on top of that and make something that's really bespoke and really amazing, but isn't as risky as completely from ground up custom software. And that's what these guys do, right? So they come in and they start there. And then they talk about all the reasons to pick them, which is, you know, everybody on the team is certified on this handful of headless software platforms. They have this pre-built thing and they talk about that and what it is and how many hours of development time it saves people. And then they talk about the 9 million successful deployments they've already had that are exactly like what the customer is looking to do. So at the beginning, when you're a services business, it's hard to do that because you don't have an area of specialization. But I mean, like, Diane, even if I look at you, right? Like, you don't go and say, hey, I do all the marketing things, which you probably could do all the marketing things, but you have an area of specialization, which is around messaging. It's the same thing with me. Like, I've been a VP marketing for 25 years. Like, I could probably do pretty much anything. It would be crappy. Unless it was a positioning. My specialization is positioning. So you don't call me because I can do all the things. You call me because I'm the person with the most experience in doing B2B positioning for tech companies, because that's all I do.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. I mean, it speaks to, particularly for services, I think it speaks to something that we hear over and over again, which is you can't do all the things. When you try to do all the things, you're having this conversation with no one, and you try to speak to everyone, you speak to no one. So I think it kind of,
that's right,
it really supports that. Seeing as you know, you just touched on messaging there, I know that in your podcast, which is brilliant, by the way, I've been listening to all the episodes, you recently mentioned that once we have our positioning and we have this validated sales pitch, this should be translated into messaging before turning it into homepage copy or any type of copy.
Totally.
So why is that? What have you seen going wrong?
Well, so, you know, what I've seen, usually what happens is we do positioning, and part of working on positioning, we get to differentiated value, which is what's the value we can deliver for a customer that no one else can. So we get that. And then usually what happens is marketing's happy because the core of our messaging is differentiated value. And we pretty much spelled it out right there in the messaging, in the positioning work. So all I got to do is figure out, well, how do I craft the beautiful words around that? Like, what's the best way to communicate it? So at the start of my career as a consultant, when I was doing positioning stuff, we would just do positioning. Marketing's like, great. They run off and do all this messaging, make it all look good. And then sales is like, yeah, this sounds good. This is great. I have no idea how to pitch it. So I'm just going to go back to showing the product. So we throw the thing over the transom and who knows what happened. So what I switched to doing was we do the positioning work. Then we go and translate that into a sales pitch using the structure we've just been talking about. And then let's test it with some prospects and see how the story lands. And so once we've been through a bunch of that testing, we know we've got a story that works. So now what we're doing is we're taking the differentiated value that we figured out in the positioning exercise and the story that we know works with prospects because we tested it. Then that goes over to marketing. Well, now marketing's got a lot more tools to work with to go build the messaging. So they understand differentiated value, so they can, you know, again, build the beautiful words that make that sing. But you've also got like this concept of your insight, and that whole setup part of the pitch is actually beautiful stuff to then go do content around. Like if you want to do thought leadership, if I'm a Help Scout and I want to do thought leadership, I can do thought leadership around this whole concept of customer service as a growth driver. Like what are the stats there? Or how does that look? Like, what do you need to understand about that in order to understand that that's really important? So I could do content around that stuff. So I kind of think, like, you know, if we really want to do a great job of messaging, we don't just need differentiated value. We need the story too. And then we can kind of play around with how we, you know, how we message that and the other kinds of content that we can make. But I think it's super important that the messaging reflects the positioning, obviously. Like, but there's more than just messaging that we're working on over on the marketing side. I don't know if that answers the question. That's me just blabbing.
I think you just blabbing is very good blabbing. You got the thumbs up from Diane for sure. I want to pick up on one of the themes of your answer just now, and also something you mentioned earlier with the IBM as well, the IBM example as well. And it's a question from Baz in the Q&A. So folks, if you've got any questions, do drop them in the Q&A or give a thumbs up to any that you like. Baz says, so much of your gold, the gold that you're spouting today, refers back to the us and them divide between marketing and sales.
Yeah.
How can you encourage sales to listen to marketing so that sales takes more of the positioning benefits driven marketing approach and sort of things?
So I am very familiar with this. I've been run marketing teams for a long time and having sales like ignore everything I do. And so here in my opinion, here's how this has to work. So the first thing is most marketers do not understand what's going on over in sales. So most marketers, I think, like as a conceptually, most marketers don't understand discovery. And so discovery is a really important thing that happens in a first call. And if you don't understand that, you don't even understand what those guys are trying to do in a first call. And so So the first thing is, I think if you want sales to take you seriously, you better understand what they're doing over there. So I think you need to, like, rather than complaining that sales doesn't understand what you do, I think maybe, you know, maybe you need to go over there and understand what they're doing. So we need to understand, what does qualification look like for your sales team? And what does discovery look like for a sales team? The second thing, the other thing we have to worry about is the sales process. So we've got a first call. What happens after a first call? How many calls do we do? What's the typical length of a deal cycle? And what happens in that deal cycle? We need to understand that as well, because it's going to impact the stuff that we give them. So that's, you know, so that's the first thing. We need to understand what happens over there so that we can serve them better. The next thing is, I got much, much better cooperation from sales if I involved sales leadership in the development of the positioning that came before the sales pitch. So if sales leadership was involved in building the positioning, then they just understand what it is we're trying to communicate better than if they weren't involved in that. So every time I do a positioning exercise, I've got product marketing and sales, you know, and whoever else from leadership, hopefully the founder, the CEO, in the room while we're working through the positioning exercise. The result of that is if sales disagrees with something, let's have it out. Like, then maybe they know something about customers that we don't know, because, by the way, sales is talking to customers all day, every day. So if they disagree with something, we should be listening to that. And it's better if we get their input when we're still working on the positioning than after it's all done and tied up in a bow and everything else, then we throw it to them and they say, I disagree with that. So having them involved in building the positioning is super, super important. Then once we've done the positioning, we need to figure out how to translate that positioning into a sales pitch. And in my opinion, that needs to be a joint effort between marketing and sales. And sometimes you even want to bring product in there if product is responsible for building the demo. So we want to do that as a team thing. Again, not marketing sitting in their little bubble, building it and then heaving it over the fence and saying, well, you know, they don't listen to me. So if we're building it together as a team, then we're by definition breaking down those walls. The last thing is, and this is very tactical, practical thing. You build the sales pitch with sales. How you roll it out on the sales team is really, really important, because so here's the thing. Your sales team loves the old pitch. Even if they tell you they hate the old pitch, they're comfortable with the old pitch because they know it. They deliver it every day, multiple times a day. Like, they love it. Like, it's like, you know, on slide three, I throw in my little joke here. And then I have my way of talking about this thing. Like, they're doing this pitch over and over again. You give them a new pitch, they don't like it. New pitch is bad. Even if the new pitch is way better than the old pitch, they're like, oh, you just messed up my flow, man. You're harshing my vibe. And so we can't just take the new pitch, heave it over to them and just say, do that. You know, if you check back in a month later, everybody's back to the old pitch. So here's the trick to make it work. First, you work with the sales leadership on the pitch itself so that sales leadership agrees that the pitch is good. Then you don't heave it over the wall. You pick one rep, your best rep. Pick the best rep. So you pick best rep, and then you train best rep on the new pitch, and then you test it with the best rep with qualified prospects. And after every test pitch you do, you go back and you say, well, what worked and what didn't work? Like, here the customer was excited, here they weren't. Maybe we need to change this word. Maybe we take this thing from the back to the front, whatever. And you do a whole bunch of cycles of that until your best rep says the magic words to you. First, I'm sick of having you review this pitch every time after I do it. I think we're done twizzling it. That's the first thing. And I like this pitch better. I'm not going back to the old pitch. Yay. Now we call that validated. Once it's validated, then I take that rep, who, by the way, is your best rep, to go back and talk to all the salespeople and say, hey, salespeople who look up to me and respect me because I am the best rep. Hey, salespeople, I'm using this new deck and it's way better than the junky old deck. And by the way, here's the list of prospects that are in the pipeline that I got with that new deck. And then I can record that rep doing the pitch and everything else. And now I got sales talking to sales instead of marketing trying to convince sales that this thing is better. This works 100,000% better than me building the thing, throwing it over the wall and going, good luck, Chuck. and doing it like that.
That's brilliant. We've got Francis in the chat saying April's describing the collaborative strategy that I'm trying to create and facilitate it for business, which is bang on. How do you know when to switch it up and change that pitch? Because like presumably you go out, you create this thing, you got the IBM thing, which goes out to many, many people. How do you know when to go, you know what, we can make this better, we could change it? And when do you just sort of sit back and relax and go, you know what, we've done this now, you know, the positioning, the sales pitch is ready.
Well, so here's the thing. If we believe and we have a process where fundamentally the sales pitch is a reflection of our positioning, the sales pitch should not be changing unless the positioning is changing. So I should actually be peeking in on the salespeople. And in a perfect world, I'm doing certification once a quarter, once or twice a year, to make sure everybody's doing the pitch in the same way that we want them to be doing it. But if it starts to change and the positioning hasn't changed, something bad, that's bad. We don't want that. And you'll get it because people get bored. So the marketing side is way worse, to tell you the truth. Like, you know, sales tend to get their groove and then they just do the same thing over and over again. But marketing gets all bored. Like after a quarter, they're like, we've been saying this forever. We're bored. Everybody should know this. And meanwhile, like it's just starting to hit. So here's the thing. There's a handful of things that can happen that will force you to go back and look at your positioning. So, you know, maybe you put out a brand new release and your capabilities are different. Therefore, the value you can deliver is different. Well, that might need a shift in your positioning. You might have a new competitor come into the market. Then that you should go back and look at the positioning. Maybe it needs to change because I've got a new competitor that we're starting to see on shortlists. And so we got to respond to that. Sometimes there's just big stuff that happens in the world. Like, you know, for example, we're in a bad economic climate. And so previously, maybe you had value propositions that were really oriented around growth, like, you know, this thing is going to help you grow and build more revenue and whatever. But economy gets soft, and all of a sudden, all your customers are in cost cutting mode. And so maybe that doesn't resonate anymore, because they're not worried about growth right now. They're worried about cutting costs. Now, most companies actually have a value proposition on both sides of those equations. So you might actually want to go back and look at what's value to your customers now. And maybe your value is more around, here's how you're going to save money versus here's how you're going to make money. But any of these things start changing, you need to go back, look at the positioning first, rework the positioning, and then build the sales pitch that reflects that. So the sales pitch shouldn't change if your positioning's not changing, but there are cases where you absolutely want to change your positioning. My experience is that we actually want to do a regular check-in on the positioning, whether we think anything's changing or not, just in case sales or product or somebody is seeing something change out in the field that we didn't notice. So if we have a checkpoint every 6 months, then we can get the gang together and say, competitive landscape, has anything changed here? Differentiated capabilities. Maybe our competitors have caught up to us and some of these things that used to be differentiating aren't differentiating anymore. And therefore, does our differentiated value need to change? If it does, then we need to rework the positioning and rework the sales pitch to go with that. If we're doing that regularly every 6 months or so, then, you know, we're guarding against something sneaking up on us that we weren't necessarily paying attention to.
Yeah, so we have some brilliant questions from the audience. I'm going to dive into the audience questions now. Alice has asked, this might be an obvious question, but is positioning similar to the USPs of a business and how do they differ?
Yeah, so in my mind, I think USP is just another way of saying differentiated value, I think. Like can I just sidebar? Marketers drive me nuts. Like everybody's got to have 19 definitions for a thing, and it makes it really hard to talk about stuff. Like if I say branding, like what does that even mean? There's so many definitions of branding, it makes it hard to talk about stuff. So, you know, a unique selling proposition, or in my mind, is the same thing as differentiated value, right? It's the same thing. It's what is the thing that I can deliver for customers that no one else can? So whatever, however we want to call it, that thing is actually super important. It's the core of our positioning and actually the core of our sales story as well.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I don't know how new marketers do it, right? Like new marketers must come in and just be like, I don't know what anyone's talking about. Because we have 19 definitions for everything.
It is like, it's like death by acronym.
Right? It must be just the worst, the worst. And then we can't leave well enough alone. Like even when we have something that's perfectly fine, somebody's got to come along and give it a new name. And so every time there's like a new thing pops up, I'm like that crusty old lady that goes, yeah. ABM, that's target account selling, man. We've been doing that forever. I know we're doing it better now, but we have actually been doing that forever. Same thing with product-led growth. It's like, we've been doing free trials forever. We're doing it way better now, but trust me, it actually isn't all that new, but okay.
I love it. It's so true. But hey, we'll keep the marketing meetup going forever because we will.
That's right. Because nobody understands what the heck is going on. So everybody needs education.
We're all confused in a lovely I want to take the question from Amy because I think it's a fabulous one. And it refers back to your three-step sales process or the three questions that you ask at the beginning. So Amy asks whether the three-step process you spoke about applies to cold calls or calls someone who has only interacted a little bit with your brand before, yes. Or is this the first call that's been agreed and set up and they already know who you are?
Right. So typically, and there's lots of variations on this. So, lots of companies won't do it this way, but typically if you have a direct sales organization, what you have is marketing is doing some kind of marketing that is giving customers the opportunity to, fill out a form or attend an event or put their hand up in some way. If it's product-led growth, maybe it's signing up for the free version or doing certain things inside the product, but the customer is doing something that indicates that maybe they would benefit from a conversation with sales. And so most companies will then have an inside sales rep reach out to them and attempt to qualify them. And that qualification is usually some form of, do you have a problem that we can solve? So they call that do you ever hear your BANT qualification? It's budget, authority, need, timing. Most folks are doing some combination of that. So the N is need. And so, do they have a problem that we can solve? So are they a good fit for our stuff? Do they meet our criteria that would make us think that, yeah, they probably have enough budget to spend on our stuff. So they're a good fit for us on the pricing side. Is this the right person? Or do I actually have to talk to somebody else in the organization to get a deal done? And, does it look like they're in a purchase process yet or not? And so that call where the inside rep is reaching out and trying to get a customer to talk to them, you're not usually doing this full sales pitch in that call because usually this is not a call you had set up in advance. You're kind of interrupting them. You're showing up and going, hey, maybe you want to talk to us about some stuff. And so that call usually involves a hook. So it's some kind of a thing that would make the customer go, yeah, all right, I'll give you 20 minutes. And so, like, for example, I worked at a company and we sold this stuff for big retail companies. And so our hook was we would reach out and say, look, like, we're working with a competitor of yours. And if you give us 20 minutes, we'll show you what we're doing with them. And most of the folks would be like, okay, yeah, I kind of want to know what my competitor's doing. So yeah, I'll give you 20 minutes. Let's see what you got. And so, but usually, so that's qualification. And then you get to what I would call a first substantive sales call, which is we haven't done discovery. We don't know that much about the customer. We know that they've, they've been lightly qualified in some way, but then we're going to do the first sales pitch and get into the, here's what we are. This is what we do. This is the value we can deliver. This is why you should pick us. Now, if it's an enterprise kind of thing, we're going to do 59 calls after that. Like, we're going to have another call. We're going to define the project. We're going to do all kinds of things. If it's a low price point product, maybe I close them at the end of that call and that's it. If it's a really low price point product, maybe I'm doing qualification and the pitch in the same call. So I do the little qualification thing up front. If they look like they qualify, then I just run straight into the pitch. That's actually very efficient for everybody. But a lot of times we don't do that because, you know, sales is a very expensive resource. And so we don't want our salespeople wasting any time on folks that aren't actually qualified. So normally we would separate that out. But sometimes I've seen companies do it. And in certain cases, it works really well where you do the qualification. If they qualify, then, I got you on the phone. Why don't I should just try to pitch you? And so they do. If they don't qualify, then they're like, oh, sorry, I don't think we're the right one for you. Nice talking to you. Bye. So that's kind of how it works. So in my mind, a typical sales organization, this pitch structure, which to be clear is, the setup and then the follow through. So I do the three steps and then I get to the differentiated value piece that if we wanted to get gory about it is actually an additional five steps, but it's fine. That is usually what we're doing in what I would call first substantive call, which is they've been qualified, we set up the first meeting with the account executive. And this is where we probably got half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, maybe an hour. And and the customer's showing up and saying, all right, show me the stuff. Let's see it.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think it's a really useful and important distinction as well for us to have in front of mind to really define, whether we are qualifying or whether we are in that actual substantive sales pitch. We've got a brilliant question here from Brendan. I think talking about sales and marketing, this has come up quite a lot in the chat as well. Is there a way for to use marketing to test our sales pitch? So he asks, he's thinking something like paid social campaigns to take a sales pitch to market or test at scale. So I think we've touched on this, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So when I started out, that's what I wanted to do because I'm the head of marketing. So I have control over that. So it would be way easier if I could just test it without having to involve the sales guys who don't actually cooperate with me all that well. So it would be nice for me to do. And at the beginning, we would do positioning stuff and then I would write messaging and then we would try to test the messaging that way. The problem with that is that now I'm not testing positioning, I'm testing messaging. And so messaging is different. Messaging is, the words on the page. If I'm trying to test that with a landing page or an ad or something, well, now I'm not just testing messaging even. I'm testing the design. I'm testing my ability to drive real qualified traffic to that. So, if it doesn't perform well, is it because the ad was bad or is it because the traffic wasn't really our people? So if what I really wanted to test is the positioning, it's actually best to test it with a qualified prospect. So then I'm controlling for a lot of things. I'm controlling for, is this the right person? Yes, it is. I'm also getting a lot more signal from the customer because I can see them and I can see like, are they scrunching their face like this? Or are they looking excited? And then I can hear the questions they ask. Like a lot of times what you'll get is the customer will go, oh yeah, yeah, I get it. That's great. So you're just like Salesforce. And you're nothing like Salesforce. And so they would have been clicking on your ad and been totally out to lunch. And so I don't get that in something like, A/B testing a page or testing ads or whatever. So testing it live with prospects is actually, in my opinion, the best way to test positioning. And I'm also testing the sales pitch while I'm at it. Now, messaging is a whole different thing. So if what I'm testing is messaging, then yeah, maybe I do want to test messaging on A/B tests on landing pages or things that I'm, if I want to test my ad messaging and my ad design and all that stuff, I should be testing that. But make no mistakes, you are not testing the positioning at that point. You're testing the stuff downstream from positioning at that point. So yeah, it sucks because you're in marketing and you want to just do your marketing thing and not have to involve the whole world to make it work. But if you have salespeople on your team, you're going to have to get really used to collaborating with sales. Like you got to make these people your best buddy and you're going to be working on a lot of stuff together because the rubber meets the road over there. Like you can be doing an amazing, perfect, genius marketing job over here. And if the wheels come off the bus over in sales, who gets fired? You get fired because those leads were crap, blah, blah, blah. Like everyone's scared to fire the head of sales. Head of marketing, woo, we get rid of them easy. So your success depends on their success. And so the more you can work with those people, the happier everybody's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more with this. And obviously it's almost kind of the reason that I focused on messaging because I saw this big jump and this kind of chasm, this area that so many companies are jumping across and trying to go straight into copy and test everything. It's like, but let's,
right,
like, what do you want to say before how do you want to say it,
right?
And so that's where this kind of in-between bit is really important. Before we dive into another question, I think this has come up a little bit in the chat. And we've been talking a lot about the relationship between sales and marketing. And I know you've mentioned before, I think on your podcast as well, that most positioning does fail because it doesn't survive that jump from marketing, yeah, to sales. This series, you know, we're talking about doing a lot with a little. And what happens when the division between sales and marketing isn't so clearly defined? Like, maybe there are people in the audience that have, you know, the founder's doing sales, or the marketing manager is also doing a bit of sales, or like, how, right, do we approach this differently when that's not so clear cut?
Oh man, like in my perfect world, marketing is doing sales. Like, you know, the best time I ever had was when I was working at a company and they gave me inside sales. And I was like, oh yes, everything's going to work good now. We're not going to have one more fight about, is this a qualified lead or not, man? Because I own all of it. So that made me very happy. But so, you know, in this idea of doing more than less, so there's, you know, so there's kind of a bunch of things. So one is, a lot of the companies that I'm working with right now, they come to me, we tighten up the positioning, we get a really good sales pitch. And the cool thing about fixing your sales pitch is there's immediate impact on that. Like, it might take you a while to get the messaging perfect and test it and get it rolled out across all the way and get campaigns running and then have those campaigns filter leads all the way down to sales and whatever. But if you got pipeline right now and you can do a way better job of pitching everybody that comes through that pipeline, that is immediate impact on revenue. So if I was sitting around right now and thinking, what could I do right now to, like, you know, improve revenue, like tightening up the sales pitch is an easy thing to do. I mean, maybe not easy, but it's a fast thing to do. And if you can do that successfully, immediate impact, it's cool. So there's that. You know, if you've got this thing where, like, oh man, founder-led sale, that's a whole different kettle of fish. So, I mean, it's one thing for, like, you and the salespeople to all get along. It's like the founder's a whole different thing. Like, it's very hard to influence the founder, especially if the founder's got a pitch that they love. You're not changing it, like, is my experience. Like, you're better to just get on board with that pitch and make your marketing match it so that you're not in constantly having a fight. And then if it's not working, it's going to show up in revenue. And then, you know, the founder is going to come to you and then we're going to have the hard conversation about it. But I don't think it's very, in my experience, I have never successfully influenced a founder around pitch structure directly. Like, I've done it indirectly where I'm just pointing stuff out in the pitches. Like, hey, do you ever notice that everybody always compares us to Salesforce, but we don't actually compete in that market? Do you ever notice that? All right. So, do you ever notice you get to the end and you're always getting this question, why would I pay for this? Doesn't seem like they understand our value. You know, but they're going to have to come to their own conclusions. I can't come in and tell the founder his baby's ugly. Like, it's just not going to work. And so if you're in that situation, you have two choices. Like, one is, maybe the founder's right. You know, like, founder built the product, had the product, like, she's the one been selling it forever. Like, maybe she's right. And maybe you need to get your head around whatever magic is happening in those sales calls. Like, I'd be trying to listen to those sales calls and find out, like, is this good? And if it looks like it's good because it's driving revenue, well, then maybe I need to get on board with that with my marketing. Or I sit on those sales calls and it's a disaster and we're not selling anything and everything's a disaster and I'm still being asked to drive a whole bunch of pipeline and whatever. Then my friend, the thing to do there is to, like, use your feet and get out. Because there's no fixing that one. in my opinion.
No, and you know, that sometimes that's just the best advice. So thank you so much. You mentioned in that answer there was a moment there where you said about smaller businesses being able to just really tighten the positioning, like really incredibly quickly. And that's a great way to squeeze what you can out the pipeline, for want
that's
of
right.
Turn of phrase. Acknowledging that there's sort of a minute or two left, if you were to spend an hour or two doing one or two specific actions to tighten positioning or indeed the sales pitch, where would you start? Acknowledging that's a very general question to ask as we finish out.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. So the first thing is I would back up and look at the positioning. So like I'm looking in the chat and somebody's like, I showed our founder, Andy Raskin's best sales deck ever on article. He was 100% would recommend it. Like that pitch structure, it's really interesting. And I think, you know, it's better than no pitch structure. But what I don't like about it is there is no connection to positioning in it at all. It has this idea that we can just make up a pitch and then back everything else into it. And I don't think that's like, I think we have to do positioning first. We can't just go straight to the pitch and skip the positioning. Like if we don't understand what our differentiated value is, we're going to end up with a pitch that doesn't really help us stand out and win any business. So the first thing we'd have to go back to is let's look at the positioning. Do we really understand who we compete with, how we're different, what's the value we can deliver? Once we have that, then we can translate that into a sales pitch. What most folks are missing is a structure to do either of those things. So, you know, my first book, Obviously Awesome, was an attempt at here's a structure for actually doing positioning, step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that's one structure you could use. There's other structures to do it. And then once you have that positioning, then I think you translate that into a sales pitch. And again, there's other structures out there. My new book is one attempt to do a structure at that. And that Andy Raskin thing is another structure, but it's got to be rooted in your positioning. You can't just go straight to the pitch and say, you know, we're just going to tighten up the pitch. We'll tighten it up. How, where, when? And we have to have the positioning in order to do that.
Bang on. Well, thank you very much. That's a cracking answer. And not that you were doing this, but a message that I got loud and clear from that was go and buy the first book and then go and buy the second book on October the 4th as well, because like they are absolutely brilliant. Well, the first one was brilliant, and I'm sure the second one will be as well, April. So thank you very much. There thank we go. We've got Jules in the chat saying just bought both.
Oh, thanks. Hey. I love it. Yeah, the book is not like the second book's not officially available till October the 4th or something, which I think is next week. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bah.
You're the world's busiest human at the moment, April, so I just want to say mirror the chat from everyone who's just been saying that it's absolute gold from you. And you got Yuval in the chat saying, April, you nailed your positioning as well, which
thank you.
Is really brilliant. So thank you very much. Diane, thank you as well. I mean, like, as a first co-hosting thing, it's been incredible. And also thank you.
I think the co-host thing's working really good for you too. This is a good team situation here. I like it.
I like it a lot too. We should definitely do it again.
Yeah. No, it's been good fun. It's been brilliant. And you know, I like you said, Joe, I think there have been many sales that have happened during this session as well. The book, it's been fantastic.
It's been great.
Awesome.
So thank you, everyone. And we will see you back next week where we're speaking personal branding. Until then, look forward to the write-up of today's session, and go check out April's new book as well. So take care, everyone, and see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.